Hello and welcome to another episode of Sniffing the Pages. I'm Nina Manning.
I'm Katie Griffiths.
And on this episode, we'll be discussing Tiger by Polly Clark, a mesmerising and epic literary novel set between the wilds of Siberia and the UK about mothers, daughters and the wild side of female nature. Also, we will be discussing We Are Not Okay by Natalia Gomez, a stunning novel about how dangerous secrets and shame can be. We'll also be hearing what Katie read next, and we will also be discussing book clubs, as well as giving you two more reads that we'll be discussing in the next podcast. Tiger, as that was the one that you read last. So, Tiger by Polly Clark. Shall I read the blurb?
Yeah,
I don't know if it might be the blurb, but this is the bit of info we got with the book. Tiger is a bewitching novel that brings together three humans and a tiger, and soon legions of enchanted readers, in the snow-smothered Siberian forest. Frida is a primatologist, sensitively attuned to her research of animal behaviour. A violent attack shatters her world, and battling addiction and her fears, she must start afresh at Torbett Zoo as they prepare to welcome their new ward, a magnificent Siberian tiger. Thomas is a Russian conservationist, steward of one of the world's harshest environments, who fears that the natural order of the forest has been toppled. The king tiger has been killed by poachers, and a spectacular tigress now prowls its vast territory. In the freezing winter, when all living things compete ruthlessly for survival, the tiger's path crosses with a native mother and a daughter, eking out a defiant but perilous existence in the snow-shrouded wilderness. To control her domain, The Undenge? I'm going to say Undenge.
Yeah, I forgot to Google how to pronounce that one, sorry.
The Undenge people tell tales of how the tiger must punish every infraction. They bear grudges. They never forget. They will kill those who try and fail to kill them. The fourth and final narrative takes the reader deep into the world of the tiger herself, a magnificently immersive reading experience. Tiger plunges the reader into one of the world's last surviving wild places with blistering authenticity. What do we think of that? Is it a good
That is a good summary, actually. That's slightly longer than the blurb that's on the bit.
Actually, I know. It's a bit blubber. Tongue tied after all of that.
Yeah, it's an amazing book. It's so... I guess immersive is the word I just used there, and that's a really good word for it. Yeah. Like it's written in such a... It's beautifully written, for starters. Like, Polly Clark, who wrote it, was a poet before she was published... poetry collections before she started writing novels. And you can really feel that from the prose. Like, it's absolutely gorgeously written. You would just want to sort of sink into it. And I loved the bit from the perspective of the tiger.
Oh,
it's quite a long way through, but it's just,
I wanted that to go on for longer, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, the tigers themselves are as much characters as the people in the books. And I think we were saying before we started that before she wrote this book, Polly Clark did huge amount of research. Actually went to the wilds of the Russian tiger I don't know how you say that, but and lived there for a few weeks, learned how to track these animals and spent time in their actual environment. And that really, I feel that comes through, because it's, she really treats them with huge amounts of respect and admiration. Like, you can really tell that she loves these creatures and thinks they're incredible, and she really wants to convey that, and it absolutely comes across.
I don't think you could have written a book like this if you hadn't have had that sort of experience.
No, I mean, I think that
every single word,
on the ground knowledge makes it feel authentic and real, and also that you really get a sense of how she genuinely feels for them. Like, they're just magnificent.
Yeah, and how much more do you love tigers now as a result? I feel like,
I mean, I've learned a lot about tigers as well. I didn't really know that much about tigers. They go raw. Like, that's the limit that we're at in this house.
It's quite a chubby one in the picture there. There's some pictures here on the back of with Polly Clark, not on the back of the book, on the back of the press release. And she's in a lovely picture of Polly looking all snowy and frosty. Tiger. And yeah, quite a chubby little tiger there. Snow seems to have gone then, so I suppose maybe he's had a nice feast.
As well,
a nice full tummy.
Yeah, the sense of the tigers is that, as like kind of characters, but also the place, the sense of place in it is, again, because I guess she's been there and she's lived it and they sort of experienced it, so it feels very...
Yeah, and the fact that the book is written in four different sections So the first section, the main first section, starts with Frida.
Yeah.
And it almost feels like four different books, doesn't it? Because thinking back to Frida's story, having finished the book, it feels like a completely different story.
It starts differently to how it ends. And obviously, so towards the end, it does kind of pull together all the threads. So there's these sort of four strands of story that do get pulled together at the end. And I really liked the way that was handled. Because I did kind of think halfway through, I wonder where this is going or if it's going to tie together, because they feel really removed.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, they do come together in the final chapter, don't they?
I don't think I'd read her writing anything. It's so beautiful. But anyway, like the prose and the lyricism of it. But also, I don't know, I think when I first started, I struggled a little bit with Frida's story, just because I found her a little bit frustrating as a character.
Yeah.
And she's clearly a victim of trauma and dealing with trauma and addiction. And
it's an interesting story, and it makes you wonder where Frida came from.
Yeah, so Polly's not so mind, much Frida and her, the struggles that she was having with addiction and her and adjusting to her world, but how she reacted to the male characters, I found very difficult to read or difficult to identify with.
Mm.
It made me frustrated with her, but that's probably as much on me as it is on the writing. And I think in some ways I think you're meant to feel like that with her, that kind of sense of slight frustration, or in comparison with the tiger, who's so powerful and so completely in control and in charge of her world.
And I've seen videos of you on YouTube or whatever, or programs of men and women who go into the wild and they forge these relationships with tigers, and then they remember them and they go back and they fight with them and play with them.
Yeah.
And it's so fascinating to watch.
And I think it's nice.
There's the scene in the book, isn't there, with Frida and is it Charlie? Oh, I can't remember the other name of the Gabriel.
Yeah, and the tiger
who goes in there.
So she starts off as a primatologist, so she's working with bonobo chimps. And what I quite enjoyed is obviously bonobos, because they're quite close to humans, they're really clearly intelligent on a level that you can recognise as a human. You can recognise that sort of intelligence in them. And her kind of discovering and falling in love with the tiger, and how the tiger operates and how it is, was really enjoyable. I sort of felt like it took the reader on that journey where you've gone from not really understanding them to actually understanding that they're hugely complex, really magnificent, beautiful creatures. Mm. And also with this level of fierce and wild intelligence in their own way and in their own right, that doesn't necessarily compare to what we necessarily think is intelligence in a human sense, but it's nonetheless very real.
And my definite favourite characters were Valerie and Edit.
Yes, and the little girl is Xena.
And then they have Xena, don't they?
Yeah, Xena.
Oh,
Xena is my favourite.
I loved them as a couple, and it was so sad because actually, it was quite difficult to try and work out at what point that they weren't in love and it wasn't going to work out for them, because in so many ways, she had so many wonderful things to say about him.
Yeah, it was a beautiful piece of writing about a relationship and how a relationship falls apart.
There's some few really interesting things in there. Yeah, I should have turned the pages down, actually. There's a couple of really poignant phrases that she wrote about something about what a difference it makes on the few occasions when he does a few things for her.
And what she's prepared to forgive for him.
That's right. Changes her perspective.
She'll forgive a lot of big things for him doing for little gestures. And I just thought, because there's no real really clear cast iron reason why they fall out of love or why they split apart. And when we first meet Edit, she's obviously separate from him already. I like that because that's clearly the case. Like most in relationships, things don't fall apart because of one clear-cut reason. It's a lot of tiny little things accumulating together, sort of breaking apart what seems to be a very positive and loving relationship early on, and where she seemed to be very happy. And I said it several times already, but it's beautifully written. Like it's so, it uses language in a way that really expresses things that you wouldn't necessarily think to express, but when you read them, you're like, yes, that's true.
It's totally on point.
Yeah, that really like strikes a chord with me. without necessarily knowing how the words to express it yourself.
Yeah, to be able to do that, as well as put you in that sense of place, and to do all the other things that she did within the book. Build those characters, get inside all of their heads, get inside the head of the tiger, put you right there in the middle of the forest.
Yeah, bring that sense of both the sort of sense of epic grandeur with the sort of the wilds of Russia and this natural habitat and the fierceness and wildness of the tiger, as well as managing the very intimate details of relationship, is brilliant writing, really, because it's both, it manages to be both a bit epic and intimate at once, and do both really, really well.
And then the third character, Thomas, he was interesting, actually, and his dad was quite an interesting character, Ivan, wasn't it? Thomas and his dad was Ivan, so they're getting another tricky relationship there, but...
Yeah, a lot of parent-child relationships, which were interesting, and then it was nice because it then mirrors that with the tiger and her cub as well, and that kind of... I really felt that the relationship between the tiger and her cub mirrored the relationship between Edith and Xena, that kind of fierce maternal protectiveness and existing against the odds in a harsh wilderness, etc.
And it's interesting that they remember, so I guess this is true, so I guess that, I mean, is
with
absolutely...
the amount of research that she's done, I'm going to assume that she's right on this matter. So a tiger, if you take part of its kill, will come and find it and reclaim it, and also if you try and fail to kill a tiger, it will mark you and then come and finish you off. Which is, I mean, I'm never going to try and kill a tiger, so it's fine, but it's quite amazing, actually, like that. It's a level of intelligence on a sort of level that, you don't necessarily consider, but it is very, I'm not sure what the word is, impressive sounds really patronising towards a tiger, that's not what I mean. Very powerful, maybe. I learned lots about tigers.
Yeah, absolutely, me too. I think there's only been another book that I can remember recently that I read, a book by Jodie Picoult called Leaving Time, which was about elephants, as one part, because she writes her books where there's a story, but then there's also a sort of sub-story, which then teaches you something. And in this case, it was all about elephants and the lives of elephants and just all their rituals and how they live and sort of live together. It was fantastic. So I learnt a lot about elephants then, and I feel this is probably the next book that I've read since then. I was chatting to an author recently, and she said she keeps books on her desk that she flicks through from time to time, just opens it up on a page and, you know, says, that is how I want to write. And I think that will be my Bible go-to.
Absolutely. I mean,
every now and again, if I need...
book. What you think?
A bit of inspiration, or just that little bit of...
I wish I had written that.
Yeah.
When you read it, where you just think, because of the power of the descriptions in it and the sort of visceral sense of realness you get from it, I would be delighted to have read it.
I
have read it.
Yeah, but it's good to have a book that you wish you had written, so that would be...
Yeah, I think that's definitely yours. Those kind of... Yeah, the way that she uses phrases, the way that she uses language is really beautiful and really moving.
Awesome.
And powerful. So yeah, this is clearly a rave review.
Yeah, it's a 5-star book for sure.
Yeah, five stars. It was fantastic. So the only problem I had with it was just that the way that Frieda reacted to the men, and then how that also sort of, that kind of came back at the end in the very sort of final closing part of her narrative. And I found that a bit jarring or difficult, but...
She had quite some psychological issues going on, didn't she?
Yeah, so I think that's probably within that. That makes sense. So.
Brilliant book.
So yeah, wonderful book. Read it.
So, the next book we read was We Are Not Okay by Natalia Gomez.
Holding out what's her down for me to read. So I'll read the back. It says, Lucy loves to gossip. If she's pointing fingers at everyone else, no one will see the secret she's hiding. Yolana comes from a conservative Muslim family where reputation is everything. One rumour, true or false, can destroy futures. Trina likes to party. She's kissed a lot of boys at school. She didn't say yes that night, but no one believes her. And Sophia loved her boyfriend. When he asked her to pose for photos, she didn't hesitate. But then he betrayed her trust. So why is she the one being shamed? Yeah. So this is, and that's the only thing we should have. This is a young adult novel.
We should say that.
Which is the first one we've
Do you have a ghost? Do we need to address this?
Should I just go check there
with knock on
my door?
There's some...
I have a cat. It might be a cat.
Oh, okay. These animals, they like
with
to...
With knocking sound in the background.
They like to intrude on our podcast time, don't they? It's a young adult novel, yes, we should say that. Which I found really interesting because, A, I don't read that many young adult novels. And the ones that I have read have had more of a theme that's not necessarily related to teenage relationships.
Yeah.
Although so there's teenagers in it.
In some young adult novels, you read them. And I think some young adult novels, I read them and think I can... There is much for, you know, adults can enjoy them in the same way that young adults can. Mm. This one did feel very specifically written for an age group, and I was aware when I was reading it that I was not in that age group, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But that's fine, because it wasn't written for my age group, so it's completely reasonable for that to be the case.
It was almost like at times I was sat on the back of a bus listening to some teenage conversation and thinking, shut up, get a grip, listen to yourself, would you? Which, I mean, I don't hang around with teenagers, so I don't know, but I presume this is what they talk about. This is how they talk.
So, I mean, I think that one of the things about it is that it's... I mean, really, the book is about, I guess, cyberbullying. So secrets and hiding, but...
It's about living in a...
The theme is this sort of, sort of online...
Living in an age of social media, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, what you say online to someone is being read and felt by someone. It's not... You don't just type the words out and they go off into, like, a cyberspace and no one ever gets hurt by them. They are really, really real. And I think, you know, it's a it's an important book and it's a quite powerful book for people of that age.
I think it will be, won't it?
I think so, yeah, because it's a you know, it's a genuine, very real problem. And the way that this book goes, the outcomes that happen in it, I'm not going to say what happens because I don't want to ruin it for anyone who might want to read it, but the way that it pans out, it's a story that is all too real.
Yeah, and I'm really glad that the ending came when it did. It came a little bit too late, in my opinion. I was thinking there needed to be a little bit more impact, a little bit more a result of people's, the consequence of people's behaviour. I felt that needed to be a little bit more played out towards the end. It was there, but I felt like it came
tidied up a little bit too neatly.
Because I got to a point where I was thinking, I really hope that something is going to be said here so that the children, you know, the young adults that go away and read this novel come away with a clear message.
I mean, I think the message for me that came out of it is about talking about it.
Mm.
So, you know, I was interested to read it because my daughter's only 4 at the moment, but she will be one day, a young adult.
Yeah.
And she's going to grow up in a world of social media and, an online presence that absolutely was not part of my teenage years or my growing up. So...
Mm.
The takeaway for me is about being able to talk to someone about it, because the big problem that everybody had, the problems with all the girls in the book, is that nobody felt able to vocalise what was happening because of the sort of the shame of it.
And because they were so immersed in their worlds and their friendships that they didn't want to upset anybody, offend anybody, or feel like they were standing out. Because the thing about teenagers...
Nobody wants to be the one that stands up and says...
You become a clan, don't you? As soon as you hit teenagers, adolescents, you want to aside from the odd few who, you know, stand out, most of the time, people want to follow the crowd. They want to do what everyone else is doing. They don't want to look different or seem to be doing anything different.
Yeah, you want to fly under the radar. You want to be able to seem to be normal, in inverted commas. You can't see my inverted commas because I'm on a podcast. I was doing them with
my fingers. But there was some lovely inverted commas there.
Yeah. Mm. I think the thing I felt was particularly clear with, I think, maybe Sophia and Trina, is that it's just... There's always more beneath the surface of people than you perceive.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably the thing, take home thing, is that everybody's struggling with their own shit, basically. Mm-hmm. No matter how perfect the perfect girl looks, she's got problems.
Have you ever had a situation in your life where you've become friends with somebody that you initially looked at and thought, she's a bitch?
Yeah, definitely.
Don't want to be friends with her.
I think, because you meet people in your own sort of personal history.
Obviously,
and preconceptions.
Obviously, in your youth, I'm not talking about in your 30s.
It would be really awkward if I turn around and be like, yes. Since moving to this...
Is there something you need to tell me, Katie?
No, but definitely when you're younger, I think, because you have your own sort of preconceptions when you meet people and your own kind of personal, you tend to project maybe your own issues onto other people, or own insecurities, and
yeah,
and judge people, because it helps you feel better about yourself. Like, everybody does that instinctively, I think, particularly when you're a teenager.
Yeah.
And it also addresses this thing that is part of, you know, again, sort of Me Too movement stuff, where why is it always the woman who's at fault?
Mm-hmm.
You know, in this case, the male character in the book behave, particularly one, far worse than
twice
any of the girls.
On a couple of occasions.
Yeah, absolutely.
And actually, I was worried at one point he was then going to be the third culprit as well.
Yeah, there was a concern.
And when that last name popped up, I was like, oh, that's okay.
I'm so glad it wasn't him again. God. That one guy, just ruined everyone's life. But yeah, that kind of... It's true in high school, or secondary school, whatever we call it in this country.
Yeah, it was clearly based in England,
yeah,
wasn't there? Because there was a lot of references to English products.
Yeah, it was definitely set in England. That was just me being ridiculous. But you know, it's very telling that the perception was immediately to label the girl as a slut, mm-hmm. rather than to label the guy as an absolute dickhead.
And also how the girls then would perceive themselves, yeah, automatically,
absolutely. And
as
that's the
slut.
Kind of thing that, you know, if that's going on when you're at school, that's the worldview that's because society as a whole, you know, as a wider whole, also holds that opinion. And that's kind of, school's like a microcosm of it. But it does also, yeah, it means the girls grow up with this, like, underlying sense that it's their fault.
Mm.
And that they brought it on themselves, which in this case I don't think is true in any of them.
I can't quite remember. Well, I do actually remember, I was telling a lie, what I was doing at 17. And I just wonder how different things could have been for me if I was growing up during that era in a social media world.
Yeah.
And how different things would be.
It's just everything's so much more public.
It's more accessible.
Yeah.
It's easier to say things.
I think that's it. It's easy to say things. So when I was at school, there was obviously bitchiness and gossip, and there was all that crap going around. And that's always been the case. But I think social media makes it really, really escalates it. Because it's so much easier to type words on a screen and then hit send when you don't have to see the person behind the screen react. Mm. And you can dehumanise people from that distance. And to be fair, that's not a purely young adult issue at all.
Oh, no.
Quite a lot.
It's interesting.
Way too many adults who also feel that. That's
interesting, isn't it, how even though adults of our age who were not brought up in an era of social media or devices or even half the technology that we've got now, still become so immersed in it and addicted to it. And I see adults my age and older, even, you know, people sort of 20, 30, 40 years older than me, addicted to their phones.
Yeah.
I was away at the weekend, I was chatting to a friend and her husband, and they're the same age as my parents, and her husband can't, you know, he panics if the phone
is
not there. And that just shows you the addiction. And I was actually having this conversation with my daughter the other day because I was trying to explain to her how long it will be until she gets a phone. Because a lot of her friends, she's coming up for 10. A lot of her friends are already 10, coming up for 11. She's the youngest in her year and they've already got phones. And she is one of the minority in her year.
But not having one, yeah.
Yeah. So I was trying to explain to her why it's going to be a long, long time until she has one. And I was trying to explain to her the addiction and how the people who made the phones understand the minds and the
Absolutely,
brain
yeah.
and how the brains work and how the reward is released into your brain to, so, you know, if you're on social media and somebody likes something,
yeah.
automatically there's
a little hit, your brain fires up. Yeah, it's a little
and,
pleasant
yeah.
experience and then you want... More of that.
And imagine
experience.
That in a very young, impressionable brain.
I think that's part of the thing, isn't it? You know, when you're a teenager, it's hard anyway, because you're going through this process of trying to work out who you are and find your space in the world, and you're growing, you know, it's like taking those steps away from your family unit and starting to grow into your own person, and you're very impressionable, and you crave validation, or maybe that was just me, but I think most teenagers,
everybody
like,
does,
even as adults,
we all do, and that's the problem. That
it's
is
really
the...
like magnified in teenagers, I think, that craving for validation, and that's what social media really can provide, because you don't have
to seek very far to get it.
No, and you can put numbers on it. As in, you can put numbers on your validation because you can say, oh, right, that one got 50, this selfie got 50 likes, this selfie got 100 likes. And do you know what I mean? Then you're starting to think, what can I do to get more? And it's really easy, it's really easily comparable. So it's a really easy place, a way to get sucked into. And it's difficult. I find it hard with the kids because it's that sense of wanting to them to be equipped to grow up in a world where technology is a huge part of a society. It's going to be a huge part of how any job that they work in, but also wanting them to stay free of it for as much as possible because it is going to take over.
And knowing when to put it down. I think that's the important lesson.
Yeah, I think it's about having and being able to put it down. You know, being able to put your phone down and not look at it for a couple of hours and not feel stressed about that.
I find it stressful, and I was away at the weekend, and we will talk about that in a minute because I keep bringing it up.
Teasing us to chat about this weekend all day.
But I didn't really use my phone, and it pinged up and said the percentage that I'd used it, you know, last week in comparison to this week or whatever. You know, and it was considerably different. And it felt so freeing and refreshing. And I mean, I was kid free and I was in a lovely area, but
probably helps as well.
Yeah. And you know, I was talking to someone the other day about this,
but it's nice to be, to take a break away from that being, it's amazing what phones bring us and what technology brings us, that sense of connectedness, how easy it is to communicate and how easy it is to keep up with people and connect with people. But also it means you're constantly plugged in to this network all the time, and it's nice to be able to unplug and walk away from it a little bit.
And it can be terrifyingly lonely as well, in the same sense. You could be surrounded by all these people online, and at the same time you can feel completely alone.
Yeah, I think it depends partly on how you use it. It's be careful to use it in a way that makes you feel good, makes you feel connected and makes you feel better, and brings you connection with people that like-minded.
I think more so in that sense that we are in an age where everybody's perfecting their lives online, and then everybody is trying to live up to that.
I think there's a quote about it. I can't remember who said it or where it comes from particularly, but basically it's that you're comparing your bloopers to everybody else's highlight reel. So people put on their social media, usually, broadly speaking, the good things or the funny things or the sort of big moments or the key moments, and they don't put on the, shit, I'm late for school again, or all the kind of other harassed crap or all the...
Yeah.
Difficulties that they're experiencing. So you look at it and think, oh my god, this person's got this amazing life because there's amazing, all these incredible beautiful things are happening, and you don't see what's underneath the surface of that. But the thing to remember is that people probably, when they look at yours as well, like I sometimes think about this, if you look, if I end up looking at someone else's Instagram,
about mine.
Yeah. I want your life.
I barely put anything up.
But
I put like one outing up a month.
Think, oh, I feel, you know, I wish that I was doing that. But then I think, well, sometimes if I was impartially looking at mine, I'd probably think, that looks great. Because you don't put on the bits that are rubbish.
And even, I was going to say, on Instagram, because I follow, let's use Father of Daughters, for example. He puts up the calamities of his life, which is funny. But even as he's doing that, you know, he's got a brilliant camera that he's shooting it on.
Yeah.
And, well, I mean, actually, it's the same one as your phone, actually, I think. It's a Google. No, it's not. It's a Google phone.
Yeah, it's a Google Pixel.
It's a Google phone, because...
I couldn't have bought that one.
Yeah, they're quite expensive, actually, aren't they?
But I think for someone
that was
him,
gifted
that's like,
to him.
It's more than a... It's just a job.
Yeah, that's his
like,
job.
They're making money out of that now. This is the thing. It's like being an Instagram influencer. I can't believe I even just said those words. But that is a legitimate career now.
Yeah.
People are making a living off of that.
Mm.
And so I also think you have to be careful when you're looking at people's online lives to be aware that, you know, they're working hard for it to look this good because it is their job.
Yeah.
Like any like people working any job.
But it sucks. That's a suck-ass job when you think about it, isn't it?
I could not do it. I mean,
I don't know how they find the time to constantly constantly record and project everything out.
Particularly during the calamities. Like, just in the middle of a tantrum, it doesn't occur to me to get my phone out and be like, this will be a hilarious Instagram encounter.
Yeah.
I'm just like, ah, stop it crying, whatever it is, please just...
I know, but...
stop screaming at me.
I also think what's really sad about this era and this book, what this book demonstrates, is like the lack of empathy that comes with the use of social media and phones and all that kind of stuff, and people constantly being in contact via technology, is that you lose that sense of empathy. That thing that when we were growing up, we understood. We could see the raised eyebrows or the frown.
I think it was
definitely
clearer. And I think that's the major takeaway I'd get from it, is that, and why I think it probably would be a good book for teenagers to read, is that it hopefully it brings that point home. You think, would I want to read this about me, basically? Like, I think you ask yourself, would I want to read this about myself? Would I want my friends to, you know, to read? Would I say this to a friend? Would I say this to myself? Mm. Or if not, would I say it to someone's face? That's a question you should also ask yourself. Like, if I wouldn't say this to their face, I shouldn't say it to them online.
Yeah, because even Google now on Google Mail, Gmail, have inputted a timer so you can stop your email. You've got up to 5 seconds or something once you've hit send.
Oh, really?
To unsend it.
When you're rage sending emails.
Which is obviously tuning into
I think that's
a
what
requirement.
It is. It's just about remembering that there's humans on the other side, and it is that empathy. And I think that's what I would hope that when I'm raising my children as the teenagers in this kind of world, that I'll help be able to remind them, is just don't assume that it's, you know, remember that there's a human being on the other side of that, just like you, who can be hurt by what you say.
Also,
be open about stuff, I guess. You know,
I was quite shocked, actually, that it took so long in the book for anything to be done about the situations that happen. Because I think the school that our children go to, bullying is dealt with immediately. I would imagine the second school that they're going to go to, bullying is going to be dealt with immediately.
I guess the problem is, so for this is the case about, so Sophia, who's, it says, you know, she's posed photos of her boyfriend, and then, you know, he betrays her trust and she's the one, but there is this sense of shame about it. So I feel like she didn't want to speak up and tell the school and get it dealt with in the way that hopefully they would have dealt with it if she had, because she was so ashamed that she'd done it in the first place. And again, that's that big thing where it's like the girl feeling that she's the one at fault for doing it, when it was firstly the guy that asked her, sort of coerced her into doing it, manipulated her because she didn't say no, I won't, because she was too scared of losing him. She's now the one that feels, oh, I shouldn't have done it, I brought this on myself, I'm too embarrassed to tell. She didn't want her parents to know, she didn't want her, I guess that was my takeaway as a parent, is make sure my children don't feel they don't want me to know stuff because they think I'll be, because they're ashamed.
Yeah, and there's a whole other world going on that potentially we may not know about. So it's our jobs, isn't it, to make sure that this things like this book don't become reality for our own kids.
Yeah, so. I think the sad thing about it is, you know, unfortunately, the things that it has been reality for kids already, and probably will continue to be, but hopefully as we sort of grow with...
There was some ridiculous story on the radio that they're saying now that, oh no, we were all wrong. It's like telling our kids that sitting in front of the TV and making is going to make your eyes go square. Actually, social media is not as bad as we thought it was initially.
Well, I think social media just is a bit of a... I don't think social media in itself is the problem. I think what it does is it amplifies problems. So for me, I don't feel like social media itself is evil or is causing mental health issues in teenagers. I just feel like it's exacerbating existing problems, so that maybe the answer isn't to stop social media, but to try and address the existing problems in the first place.
I don't know how they could have made that comparison between an old wives' tale from the 1982 that your old auntie would tell you to, you know.
Although even that, it's funny to have things you're told when you're a kid. You still, like, I still, my children sit right in front of the TV, right up close to my face, and I make your eyes go square. I know that's not true. I hear yourself spouting this nonsense.
This week I was thrilled by the new novel by Alice Feeney called I Know Who You Are. Alice Feeney has delivered a stellar follow-up novel to her debut, Sometimes I Lie. Her second novel, I Know Who You Are, is a dark and often unsettling twisty psychological thriller set between dual narratives. The protagonist, Amy Sinclair, is a successful actress battling with childhood trauma, and in the present narrative is dealing with the disappearance of her husband, a stalker, and a suspicious detective who is convinced she's guilty of something. But it's during the past narrative where Feeney takes us to the back and beyond of her contorted imagination. A young motherless Amy narrates her experience as she's abducted near her home by a woman known as Maggie and driven to Essex. Based in the late 80s, these vignettes are heartbreakingly vivid. Young Amy is quickly forced to forget her previous life and forge a new existence under a strict regime where love is offered conditionally. We are then thrust into a seedy world of borderline poverty, illegal gambling, abuse and murder, all shown to us through the eyes of a six-year-old Amy. Narratives written from the perspective of a child are a particular favourite of mine because they allow the reader to be shown so much without being told. In I Know Who You Are, Feeney's description of 80s Britain seen through the eyes of a small child is drenched with nostalgia and achingly familiar. Feeney weaves the two narratives together seamlessly, right up to the jaw-dropping crescendo. This book kept me gripped for 2 days solid. It's a fantastic psychological thriller that keeps you turning those pages and leaves you turned inside out with a slightly tainted perception of life, yet at the same time, you're desperate for it never to end. I Know Who You Are is published by HQ Stories on the 16th of May. So,
smash it.
Right. So I went away on a, I'm going to talk about this actually quickly. I went away on a reading retreat this weekend and I've been in a book club 13 years.
Best kind of retreat.
Yeah, I know. It sounds so luxurious, doesn't it? A reading
it really
retreat.
Does. I was really jealous.
I said, I used to say reading weekend and then my friend who's in the book club with me said, no, you must say reading retreat. It sounds far more glamorous. So it got me thinking in a sort of Carrie from Sex and the City, to quote, got me thinking. How book clubs have evolved, because we started off as just a foursome. Well, actually, we started off, there was bloody loads of us to start with. And then slowly we sort of, you know, they all disappeared. Yeah, they realised we were the cool ones. And they might have just had their own book club. We often
maybe
talk about
splinter book
we
clubs.
Often talk about them and wonder where they are. And so we evolved. We've evolved over the last 13 years. We started off as just a book club with nibbles on the table, you know, open bag of Quavers and a couple of cocktail sausages, to full-on meals, to now these reading retreats. And yeah, it got me thinking about book clubs in general and how they've evolved over the years and what they mean to women or men. There's quite a few good films that have come out recently as well about book clubs.
Yeah.
And so, how about you? Have you ever been in a book club?
I've been in a book club once, which actually is weird because I've always read a lot, you know, and loved books. But
you're just too busy reading the books.
I'm just reading them. Too busy reading them. I think it's a kind of a mixture of things for me for why I hadn't done it. Partly it's time, I guess, finding one. I was once in a book club at work, but nobody but me ever read the book, and I was frustrated because I quite genuinely wanted to talk about the books that I was reading, like not just go into the pub and have a drink, which is also a fun thing to do.
Mm.
But
can you shame the people on here?
No. It's a long time ago, to be fair, so I think we're probably safe from any of them hearing this anyway. But yeah, so for me that was frustrating because I genuinely joined it wanting to meet people I could talk to book about books too, which I hadn't really had massively until then. And that wasn't what it was. It was still good fun, but it wasn't that. I don't know really. I think maybe also I've never joined one because I feel like I'm not literary enough. Mm. My tastes aren't literary enough.
No, well you say this, but I had a friend who knew I was in a book club, so she always used to ask me for recommendations all the time. And then she her children went to a school and the mums all decided to form a book club. And she said, right, so what they've decided is the first book they're going to read this month is Denise Walsh's autobiography. So do you know who I mean when I say Denise Walsh? So I think I've got her name right, but she's one of the presenters from Loose Women. She's a Geordie.
Oh, okay, I think I do know who you mean.
She's an actress. She was in Corrie and all stuff like that, I think. So you don't necessarily have to.
Well, I suppose the thing is, you read the books you want to read.
It's what you want to choose, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess maybe that's just me being, I think probably it's my not wanting to.
That's a pretty poor choice for a first book.
I suppose it depends what you're into, but yeah, I would have thought it was not a particularly good book club book, just because...
There's some good autobiographies out there, but maybe...
Yeah, I don't know. I would have thought a book club book was better if you want people to get different interpretations out of it, but I suppose you read what... I mean, the thing I think about it really is that you should just read what people should just read what they enjoy.
Mm.
And like the older I've got, the more I've just thought, oh, I'm just going to read what I like and not really fussed about it.
We used to write down all the books that we read, and we did have a list for a couple of years, and then we just... got ridiculous. But we do pick a book every month, and we what's interesting is when people find out that you're in a book club, they're like, oh, how does it work? And well, we just pick a book and
we read it
and then we talk about it. But I think they want to kind of understand the logistics of it, you know, where do you meet, what do you do, what's the etiquette.
Does a different person pick the book every month? Do you take in turns? How does it work?
Should I present nibbles? Should, you know, do they bring their own drinks?
Really stressed about, like, I love recommending books to people. It's one of my favorite things to do. But I think I'd feel stressed in a book club environment, because if it's something that you loved and other people hated,
it's incredibly that kind of tense, like, personal.
Potential conflict I find quite stressful as a concept.
Incredibly personal. I'm in the Village book club, and there's a couple, and they'll laugh if they listen to this. There's a couple that I've chosen, and I'll put my hands up to one of them. It was terrible, but there was one called The Trouble with Goats and Sheep by Joanne Cannon. And she's an awesome writer.
Yeah.
And that book was fantastic, in my opinion. It homed in on some real fantastic themes and topics that really resonated with me, but I don't think anybody else saw it. And yeah, you can take away from that some quite personal,
I suppose, personal that's sense it, of rejection. Maybe for me, reading's always been a really personal thing.
Mm.
And maybe that's maybe partly why I've struggled with not gone out and joined a book club, which I probably could do.
This is our little
this is my one-on-one book club,
isn't it, really? Our
but I think, you know, even this, I wouldn't have done this a few years ago. I think I wouldn't have been brave enough to sort of put out my opinions out into the world and think that they had any value. And actually, yeah, as I get older, I just think, well, my opinion's my opinion. That's sort of all it is. But as all you say, it's a very personal thing. I think particularly books you really love or have a deep personal connection to. I don't want to hear someone else say how they thought it was shit.
Yeah.
It's just gonna hurt me. Yeah. And I'm gonna give them my, like, long rant about why that's not true.
What's quite interesting is, though, sometimes by the end of the book club meeting, people's opinions kind of turned around. Yeah, just by discussing it out loud.
What I guess I would like to do in one, and maybe I should just do in one, I guess I keep talking about this, but
there's one in the library.
Yeah.
They all look quite much older than you, so well, you'd be the young sprightly one that just rocks up.
I think
we're reading 50 Shades of Grey this week, guys.
I definitely think that it's about I don't know, I've lost what I was gonna say then.
Sorry.
No, I think when I've talked to books, like, say my mum reads a lot as well, and I often talk to my mum about, like, I recommend books to her and she recommends books to me. What I find interesting is that you, when you talk to someone about it, or when we did the podcast as well, you see things or take things from books that I don't pick up on, and probably vice versa. So it's nice to talk about it, because it gives you deeper insight into the books, I guess.
Yeah.
So, plus it's fun. Who wasn't wanting an excuse for nibbles and wine?
Yeah, there's always alcohol involved, so it's good fun. So now we come on to the section called What Katie Read Next. So what have you been reading?
So I've got two books to quickly talk about this week. So the first one is This Is Going to Hurt by Adam Kay. Like, I think pretty much everyone's already heard of this.
I'm halfway
lots of them have read
through.
It. There's really nothing I can say about it that hasn't already been said, apart from just to say that everybody's right. It's brilliant. Mm. It's so funny. Properly laugh out loud. My husband kept saying to me, what are you reading in bed? Because
I read some extracts out to him, to my, not your husband, no. I nearly said that. No, I read some extracts out to my husband in my bed, in the privacy of our own home. You were not involved in any
in
way,
no way there.
Shape, or form. And he had a chuckle as well. So.
Yeah, so it's very funny. It's very, it's also heartbreaking at times. It switches between the two beautifully and cleverly, and it's also I think it's genuinely an important book. It's a bit of a call to arms,
and also it's the first one really of this genre of books, and there's been a sort of catalogue.
Yeah, so there's definitely more books that have come out since about kind of the realities of being a doctor, junior doctor, midwives. Realities of being a nurse, midwife, exactly. And all of that it's really important. I think it's opened the floodgates for people actually finding out genuinely what it's like. Mm. And even as someone, so my family have been quite connected, have worked in the NHS and been quite connected to the NHS my whole life. So I think I've sort of, and I've worked in it as well, I felt like I had probably a better idea than some people of the realities of it. And even for me, it was like, wow, that is even more brutal than I had realised.
Mm.
Even more important, you know, to be honest with you, just how they all do it is incredible.
Mm.
Hats off to absolutely everything.
Have you got a favourite little story? Can you remember one off the top of your head?
Not off the top of my head.
I can remember one.
Also, some of them are probably not, I don't know.
You can't.
Not suitable same. For, not yeah. suitable for
There was one where there's a little lad going off for an operation and, was it the doctor says, do you have a kiss before you go?
Oh, yeah.
And then the mum gives him a kiss. And I think it's the way he writes, he says, and so the boy just got wheeled off looking a bit sort of perturbed with very dry cheeks or something. He says like that.
He's a brilliant writer. Like, he absolutely knows how to communicate. It's great, you know, I say nothing that other people haven't already said, but very much. If you haven't already read it, then...
Is he a comedian?
It. He is now, yes.
You're right, okay.
So he stopped being a junior doctor and and started a new career. So, well, script writer. But I think he also does do stand-up. He does
I think there's a second book coming out as well, is there?
There's one coming out at Christmas.
Right, oh yeah, called...
Something about...
Being on the ward at
Christmas. Yeah, being on the ward at Christmas. Or I can't remember exactly what it's called now. Mm. But yeah. So yes, that's brilliant. And the other book I read, which is another book that was recommended to me on my reading spa experience a few weeks ago, is called My Grandmother Sends Her Regards and Apologises. Mm. And it's by Frederick Beckman, who also wrote A Man Called Ove, which is quite, like, there's quite a lot of talk about at the moment.
Yeah.
Which
is still in my to-be-read pile.
Yeah, so I would definitely read more. I really like this book. When I first started, I struggled a little bit. But it's basically, it's written from the point of view of...
Did you struggle with the title?
I'm just saying it. No, it's written from the point of view of a 7-year-old, nearly 8-year-old.
Really?
Elsa, yeah.
I love books like that.
Yeah, and it really captures her. It's so well written from that perspective. So it's about her and her relationship with her granny, and her granny is her superhero. It's absolutely like the idol of her life, and she leaves her a mysterious sort of series of letters to deliver to people in who she knows, apologising for things or explaining things and basically kind of revealing some stuff to Elsa. And I guess helping her go through, it really is a book about grief and losing someone. And it's a book about losing someone when you're 7.
Mm.
And it's hard to understand loss when you're
But do you know what's so fantastic about writers that write from the perspective of a child?
Yeah.
Is that they show it and don't tell it, because from the eyes of a child, they don't always understand what's happening. So you're seeing it through the eyes of a child. Yeah. So the writer doesn't even have to say, this happened, that happened. They're literally explaining what it looks like from the eyes of a child. And but you get it, what they're writing. And it's just so fantastically done.
It is, and this is a really good example of it. And Elsa is, like, fair play, she's quite a precocious 7-year-old. So she's definitely slightly more mature or adult-seeming than perhaps most 7-year-olds. But it's just, yeah, ultimately I think it's a lovely book about grief and losing someone and being young and uncertain and how to sort of find your way through that. I don't know.
Another book that would spring to mind would be My Name Is Not Leon by Kit DeWall. Have you read that?
No.
So that's written from the perspective of, I think he's like 9 or 10 or 11 or something like that. But yeah, I love books like that, so I would definitely...
Definitely. I mean, it's one of those... another one, actually, having said that earlier about Tiger, where I read it and thought, oh, I wish I'd thought of some of this.
Hmm.
So she and her granny have a secret realm that they journey to just before she stopped... When she was younger, she stopped being able to sleep when her parents split up, Elsa. So her granny taught her of a realm you can only go to when you're almost awake, just before you go to sleep. And there's all this... So everything's set to this backdrop of this kind of fantastic world that her granny's built for her, and it's just, the whole thing is, it's really beautiful because it's kind of really, it's a real like depiction of their relationship and how quirky and funny and powerful and beautiful it is. So yeah, it's really good.
Oh, I'll have to read A Man Called Ove first and that one afterwards.
Yeah, so I would definitely would like to go and read A Man Called Ove after that, because
What else has she written?
Another one called Brit Marie was here, which it says on the back. I don't know if there might even be another one.
How old is he? Have you seen any pictures of him? Because I always like to know what the author looks like. And I didn't look up what Natalia Gomez looked like, but I do know what Polly Clark looks like, and I know what Adam Kay looks like, but...
Doesn't say, there isn't a picture. So yeah, but yeah, genuinely, great book.
Great. So the next two books we are reading for the podcast are...
The Dragon Lady by Louise Traeger.
And The Gift of Friends by Emma Hannigan.
So, look forward to talking to you about those next time.
Yeah, two very different, contrasting books.
Yeah, I think they'll be very different. Yeah. They both look great, so can't wait.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.